especially in the beginning of this course, we're going to follow relatively closely the book by Mukanov and Vinitsky. And as such, we are beginning with a relatively quick introduction to quantum fields. We will do it more carefully from fundamental principles a little later. But just to get you into the field of quantum fields quickly. So a taste of quantum fields. Here's the intuition. Consider something like the surface of a lake with waves all over the place. And let's say we are probing this wave structure. So what do we do here? Imagine you have a pond, either wavy like that, or maybe a pond that is completely flat. No waves whatsoever. There's no wind that could generate waves just yet. And then what we do is we put a cork in there. So you take a wine bottle or something, and take it, the cork, throw it into the water. And then what you will see is that it bobs up and down in an oscillatory fashion. So this cork is obviously exposed to an oscillator. You can view it as a tracer that shows what's happening there, and it will go up and down with waves. So clearly, wherever we do that, we find an oscillator. For water, it's not actually very harmonic, but it's an oscillator. And if we plot the height of the cork over time, we will get a curve something like that. What if we throw multiple corks into our lake? Then each one of these corks will have an amplitude curve like that. Its height as a function of time looks like this. And if we plot it for multiple corks, we get something like that. And of course, this is being done for reasons of climate research and so on. They will have buoys that they measure the height of, and they measure the waves and so on. What you can then do is, if you have multiple corks, is measure the correlation between the motion of the individual corks. So technically, you calculate the correlator between any two of those corks' motions. And you will find that they are correlated. Of course, if two corks are far apart from each other, in a lake which is busy with waves, then each cork will have some curve that looks nothing like the curve of another cork. But if you put the two corks close to each other into the lake, then they will still have each their own curves, but they will be strongly correlated. As you can see by eye, of course, because they will be exposed to the same waves, almost the same waves, at almost the same time, so there will be strong correlation. These correlations, in the case of quantum fields, are captured by a function, it's called the correlator, which is expressing the probability for, let's say, one cork, or in that case, field excitation to go up, given that you know that the other one went up, or vice versa. And these correlators are half of the famous Feynman rules. You can capture what is going on in the lake by capturing the statistics of the corks bobbing up and down, and in particular, how they are correlated. And for a quantum field, similarly, you can calculate those correlators, and it will tell you how particles propagate. In the case of a lake, if you know the correlator, then you can calculate what happens if you steer the lake at one point by throwing a stone in it, for example, and then checking how the corks move a little bit away from there a little bit later. So one of the central quantities in quantum field theory is going to be the correlator of measurements of the field values at different points. Now let's get back to the observation that the quarks are oscillating. Sorry. So the quarks are oscillating. In the case of quantum fields, in a good approximation, in a harmonic way, in the case of water waves, the oscillations are generally not very harmonic. But an important feature of these harmonic oscillators is that they're not independent of each other. If you place a quark here and a quark there, and it's a completely quiet lake, and you move one quark here, you excite that oscillator, that will create waves that will excite the other oscillator as well. So we can think of a lake as consisting of an oscillator at every point, but these oscillators being coupled to each other. And similarly, quantum fields can be thought of as consisting of oscillators, one oscillator at every point in space and time. And these oscillators are coupled to each other. So what we will deal with in this course is coupled systems of coupled harmonic oscillators, quantum harmonic oscillators. So in particular, the amplitude of the fields will be oscillating in a quantum way. We'll have quantum fluctuations, quantum uncertainties. So the plan for what we will do next is that we will quickly review harmonic oscillators, review relativistic fields, then I'll do a quick introduction to second quantization, and then we will discuss the harmonic oscillators of fields in particular and their vacuum fluctuations. So you see, if a lake is described as a classical system and all of these harmonic oscillators, all of these coupled harmonic oscillators are in their ground state, well then that's the case where the lake is not moving, where it just its surface just looks like a mirror. Quantum theoretically, we also have harmonic oscillators everywhere, coupled harmonic oscillators, and if they are in their ground state, then the quantum field is not like a mirror. It's not just like plain flat. But instead, there are fluctuations, because even in the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, it fluctuates. So that will be the last point there. All right, so quick review of harmonic oscillators. I hope I'm not boring you to death with these simple things, but let's start very simple, just to make sure we're all on the same page. So let's consider classical harmonic oscillators. Here we have the Hamiltonian of a classical harmonic oscillator, and its equations of motion are given by these two equations. So the main point is that the second derivative of the position variable q is proportional to the position variable, and the momentum is the time derivative of the position variable. The lowest energy solution of the harmonic oscillator, of the classical harmonic oscillator, is given by the position variable being permanently at zero and the momentum also being at zero. Therefore, the Hamiltonian is also at zero. This is zero, that is zero, Hamiltonian is zero. Here's the potential. We can visualize what's going on as the harmonic oscillator sitting simply at the bottom of the potential. In this case, we know that nothing moves in this harmonic oscillator, and we are sure about that. There is no uncertainty. That would be the case of a lake. If that applies to all of the harmonic oscillators of a lake, that would be the case where it is flat as a mirror. But then quantum mechanically, this is not so. as always, we have that the Hamiltonian and the equations of motion are unchanged in the quantization. However, we now have that there are non-trivial commutation relations between the canonically conjugate observables, in this case Q and P. So the Hamiltonian still has the same form as before. I'm just putting hats on the observables to indicate that these are quantum mechanical quantities now. So the Hamiltonian is the same, and the equations of motion are also still exactly the same. Because we are working in the Heisenberg picture here. And now, the big difference is that the Q and the P is no longer commute. Therefore, the Q and the P's can no longer be number valued. And so, the same is true for H, for the Hamiltonian. And so they are operator valued. They act on Hilbert spaces. Now, what is the lowest energy solution now? Well, the lowest energy state for a quantum harmonic oscillator, let's call it psi naught, is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with some eigenvalue E naught, which is non-zero. And the higher the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, the larger is the ground state energy of its lowest energy state. Now, why is there such a ground state energy? Why is it that the lowest energy state of the harmonic oscillator is not of energy zero? This is one of the big, this is connected to one of the big mysteries in physics today. What about the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillators in quantum fields? Ordinarily, in quantum mechanics, as we will see a little later, it doesn't matter. Because you can always add to the Hamiltonian a constant. You can always add a million joules of energy to any Hamiltonian without affecting the evolution. The reason is, and if you add to the Hamiltonian a constant times the identity operator, just to shift the spectrum up, or down if you like, then, well, you've added something proportional to the identity operator to the Hamiltonian. But how does the Hamiltonian act? How does it generate evolution? By commutation. And everything commutes with the identity operator. So therefore, the evolution of any observable is never affected if you add to the Hamiltonian a constant. A constant times the identity, which is what you would need to do to change the spectrum, to change all energy levels by a certain amount. And that's what we have here. The ground state energy is lifted from zero for the classical harmonic oscillator to 1/2 h bar omega. And you see, in gravity, which is what we will consider in this course, energy, the absolute value of the energy matters. At least it should matter. Because the Einstein equation has on the right-hand side the energy-momentum tensor. If you add something to that, then it affects what is on the left-hand side. It should affect the curvature. So in the case of gravity, in principle, we'll have to worry about that. But before we get to that, where nobody has a good answer yet, nobody really knows what happens with the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillators in quantum fields, let's address the question why there is an elevated ground state energy. Any guess why in the quantum system the energy of the ground state is elevated above zero? Why it has to be elevated above zero?
The oncertainty principle. Hmm? The uncertainty principle.
Yes, and go on.
Because if you have zero energy, then according to the delta E times delta T should be that the if you have a zero energy, then something must be infinity.
Well, if it has zero uncertainty in the energy, then you have the time energy uncertainty principle kick in, and you can tell that nothing can change. Any change takes an infinite amount of time, right? So if you want to invoke the time energy uncertainty principle for energy, well, doesn't really matter what the value is. You see, the ground state is an energy eigenstate. which means everything is stable, everything is at rest, everything is no observable changes. When you have an energy eigenstate, no observable changes. Right? That's true for any system in any state, energy eigenstate. But you were almost there. Let's see, maybe Peter knows.
I think mathematically it's because of the non-commutativity of the X and P operators.
Or if we want to say uncertainty, we can just say delta P delta Q.
Yes.
Is greater than or equal to, what is it, h bar over 2?
Right.
So if you're going to have zero energy, you have to have both P and Q equal exactly to zero.
That's not obvious. Why would that be?
Because the energy is P squared plus Q squared.
Right. Yes, exactly. And because both of them would be positive operators, none of them can undo what the other does. That's right. And then, very good point. Yes. So mathematically, you can see this as the reason, but physically, what's behind it physically?
So, I mean, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator is a Gaussian.
That's right.
And therefore, it has to be, delta x has to be like a little, it has to be limited within the hump. And, so basically it comes down to the uncertainty principle.
That's right, exactly that. Tipra had it. So, do you want to say it? Basically, it's because if we look at the ground state, we see that it's a Gaussian. So the particle is fluctuating around the position zero. But at the position zero, the potential is zero. But everywhere else, it's elevated. Which means that the particle, generally speaking, sees a potential that's finite. It only sees zero potential if it is directly at zero. But it's generally elongated because of the Gaussian. So the particle actually spends its time usually at an elevated potential position. That's the physical intuition for it. And I think it's important to see that together with the mathematical motivation, because ultimately, in quantum gravity, it's a fundamental problem what to do with the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillators of a field. And what we've seen just now is that for mathematical reasons, as well as for physical reasons, it's unavoidable that it's there. Mathematically, it's the uncertainty principle that forces that the ground state energy is elevated, that they can't both be at zero, P and Q. And physically too, the particle is not just at the zero position, it is spread out in position in the ground state, and therefore it generally sees an elevated potential where it is. Okay, so let's look at that in a little bit more detail. So the lowest energy state of the harmonic oscillator can be written down in the position eigenbasis. So let's look at the eigenbasis of the position operator Q. So that's the eigenvalue equation. So Q has three meanings here. Here it's an eigenvalue, here it's an eigenvector, and here it's the position operator. We continuum normalize the position eigenvectors. And then we remember from textbooks and calculations that hopefully you've done at some point that the ground state actually takes this form. The ground state wave function looks like this. So it is a Gaussian, e to the power minus something q squared. As a wave function, psi of q, it is, just to remind you, a wave function is not a state. A state is a vector in a Hilbert space, or given by a density matrix, which is an operator on a Hilbert space. A wave function is a collection of scalar products between the vectors of a basis and the state that we are considering. So the wave function of the state psi naught is the collection of inner products between the position eigenvectors in this case and the state that we are considering. If we chose a different basis, such as a momentum basis here, then we would get the momentum wave function and so on. So the wave function of a state is always the collection of the coefficients that this state has relative to a basis. That basis need not be a continuous basis. It could be the basis of a harmonic oscillator, or it could be the basis of a hydrogen atom, or it could be some arbitrary Hilbert basis, which might even be continuous and discrete mixed. And all of these would be called the wave function. Wave function is simply the collection of the coefficients that the state has in the basis. And here they are. What is notable here is, and we will get back to that later on, because there's going to be something counterintuitive going on with this feature as well as we go to quantum gravity or quantum field theory already. Namely, this Gaussian has a different spikiness or width depending on the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. If this harmonic oscillator has a low frequency, omega is a small positive number in this case, well then, this is a Gaussian that is very widely spread out. Right? Then it looks like that. Which means the fluctuations are, you will get large fluctuations. However, if omega is large, if the harmonic oscillator has a potential, it's very tight, so the frequency is very fast, then the Gaussian is very tight as well, very spiky. Right? This omega is in the numerator here, so that main amplitude here is growing in this case. And also for large omega, the Gaussian decays very quickly. So the takeaway message is that for small frequencies, when the Gaussian is wide, you're more likely to have large-scale fluctuations, you know, large Q fluctuations out to large Q, than if the frequency of the oscillator is high. The frequency of the oscillator is high, then the particle is much more confined to a neighborhood of zero. So then, is the oscillator at the resting position Q equals zero in the ground state? Well, in the lowest energy state, we have indeed that the expectation value of position, so that expectation value is technically this integral, where this is a Gaussian, that's the Gaussian, and here we have Q. The Gaussian is an even function, here's an even function, but that makes it an odd function because we have Q here, so it's vanishing. So what we have is that indeed the expectation value for the position is zero. Well, clearly because the Gaussian is symmetric around zero, so yeah, the position expectation value is zero. So just like in the classical theory, we expect that the particle to be at zero. It's the most likely position to find it in the ground state. But there are quantum fluctuations around that, as we of course know because of the Gaussian distribution, but we can also calculate what the standard deviation is. So if we had this harmonic oscillator prepared over and over again in this ground state, and we keep measuring the position, then we will find a huge spread of values. Well, how huge it is depends, of course, on omega. But we will find the spread of values, and the standard deviation of that spread of values around zero is calculated in this way, as usual. So it's the expectation value of the deviation from the mean squared. That's the variance. As usual in statistics, and we take the square root of the variance, we get the standard deviation. And that value comes out to be h bar divided by 2m. So that means that actual measurements of the amplitude of the elongation of the harmonic oscillator would give values which are spread around zero with this kind of standard deviation. So if you think of our lake again, and one of those oscillators at one location, if we could consider that in isolation, and if it were a quantum oscillator, we would have to say that even if the lake is as much at rest as it can possibly be, well, the water would still be fluctuating. The cork would still be fluctuating.
Question. Mm-hmm. So intuitively, one would expect that the delta value of delta Q would be perhaps related to omega?
Yes, it is, but I just didn't express it in this way.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you can express the omega in terms of m and k, and yeah, it is. That's right.
That's a k, okay. Because that's an h bar, right?
Hmm? Yeah, that's an H bar.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. And yeah, maybe I should fix this and express it in terms of omega. I mean, what do we expect? We expect that as omega increases, the standard deviation decreases. Because for high frequencies, the potential is very narrow. It's a very steep parabola, very steep quadratic potential. And the Gaussian is very narrow, so the standard deviation is small. So we expect that omega is in the denominator. Whether it's 1 over square root of omega or 1 over omega, I don't know by heart. Okay, and now we see again the intuition, as Tibra indicated earlier, because in the ground state, the wave function is like this, so the probability distribution for finding the oscillator at these elongations is spread out like that, we have that the particle or the oscillator is generally seeing the potential elevated. Right? If, for example, we had a potential that looked very different, we could imagine a potential that goes like this. It goes down like that and then does something else. I don't know. We want it stable, of course, eventually. But if you had something like that and you had a state which has a probability distribution like this, you would see that the particle is generally seeing a potential lower than zero if the potential went down there. And then you would expect and you would find that the energy expectation value is lower than zero in this case. But here we have that the potential goes up, the particle sees the potential wherever it fluctuates to, and therefore it is in a state of elevated energy.
Is there some specific reason why you're describing the zero point energy mostly in terms of the potential rather than the kinetic energy? Because there's kinetic energy as well in the ground state.
Yes, that is right. And we know that it contributes about half.
Right.
It's just that if it were for kinetic energy alone, you know, that could be, it could be at a zero energy state. And this forces it elevated. The kinetic energy can only add to it. Because it's positive. P squared term. That's a good point. Okay, so we recalled harmonic oscillators. Now let's talk about relativistic fields. Because obviously our lake analogy only goes that far. The water of a lake, the water waves are neither very well harmonic, nor is it relativistically covariant. So we'll have to look at relativistic fields now before we then do second quantization and then vacuum fluctuation. So we start with what we know, the Schrödinger equation. Schrödinger equation looks like this. Let's neglect potentials for now. Let's just look at the plain Schrödinger equation for a free particle. At this stage, we are calling psi of x and t still a wave function. But later on, of course, we will think of psi as a field. A field being any function of space and time. So here we have the Schrödinger equation. And the just to make sure about the notation, this, the Laplacian is simply the sum of the second derivatives squared. What we need is a relativistic version of it. And here's the argument of Klein and Gordon. They looked at the Schrödinger equation and they said, well, the spatial derivatives have their origin in momentum operators. The spatial derivatives minus I h bar d by dxj are really representations of the momentum operator in the position basis. And I h bar d by dt is really a representation of the energy operator. So therefore, the Schrödinger equation really takes this form. That's what the Schrödinger equation actually is. And that is just turning it into a representation in the in space and time. So ultimately, what is behind the Schrödinger equation is this equation, that the energy is p squared over 2m, which is to say that the energy is just the kinetic energy. It's just velocity squared, 1 half m velocity squared. This is also called a dispersion relation because it tells us the relationship between spatial wavelengths and temporal wavelengths, or spatial frequencies and temporal frequencies. So this is the Schrödinger equation just expresses what Newton would have written down already, which is that the energy of a free particle is just the kinetic energy. But then Newton's mechanics was, of course, not relativistic. What relativity demands is that the relationship between energy and momentum is a slightly different one, namely this one. This is the covariant relationship between energy and momentum, which is, of course, just a detailed way of writing that p naught squared minus p vector squared is equal to m squared. And at that point, Klein and Gordon said, well, let's remember what E and P stood for in, or how they were represented in the quantum theory. And they resubstituted for E, IH bar d by dt, and for P, minus IH bar d by dx. And voila, they had the Klein-Gordon equation. So at that point, they thought, OK, we're in business. We can do a covariant wave equation now. And for sure, they could go ahead and solve that as a differential equation. But then we have to ask, what did we throw out of the window here when we did this? Well, one of the things we did throw out of the window was the Hamiltonian. Right? We had a Hamiltonian for the Schrödinger equation, but now what's the Hamiltonian for this thing? And are we sure that we still have a probability amplitude interpretation? That we still have a conservation of probabilities and things like that. It turns out we don't, none of this. So there are problems with that. But they said, well, never mind the interpretation. We have an equation of motion. Let's just try to solve it. So here's the Klein-Gordon equation. It's usually written in this way, or, well, in this way, and by that I mean, we choose units such that h bar is equal to 1 and such that the speed of light c is also numerically equal to 1. And then this combination here, the second time derivative minus the sum of the second space derivatives, is put together, this combination is together called the D'Alembertian. And that's the D'Alembertian for Minkowski space. As we will later see, on curved space-time, of course, the D'Alembertian will take a more complicated form. But for now, it's just the second time derivative minus the sum of the second space derivatives. Now, one thing that that we have to check here is that there is some non-relativistic limit. See, in the previous slide, I explained that Klein and Gordon said the Schrödinger equation is the equation E equal to P squared over 2m, which is not covariant. Instead, let me just show you again. Instead, they said, They said, this is the Schrödinger equation, not covariant. This is the relativistic dispersion relation. This is the relativistic relationship between energy and momentum. It is covariant. We should work with this. And then all they did is that they put the representation of the E and the P as derivatives back in. But in what sense is this generalizing that? In what sense does this arise from that in the non-relativistic limit? So they did some hand-waving to show that the Klein-Gordon equation reduces to the Schrödinger equation for small momenta. So they said, let's assume the Klein-Gordon equation holds. So this equation holds. Of course, the Klein-Gordon equation is in terms of derivatives. But let's write it in terms of the E's and the P's for now, which you obtain by Fourier transform. So then they said, let's take the square root of this in order to get an equation where we have E equal to something, just like in the Schrödinger equation, where it was E equal to P squared over 2m. But then if in the Klein-Gordon equation you take the square root, you're confronted with two choices. It's plus or minus the square root of this. So they said, well, let's choose the positive one. Let's worry about the negative ones later. So they choose the positive square root of that and obtain this. Now, let's assume that the particles move relatively slowly. Let's assume that the momentum is small. Now, small compared to what? Well, let's assume that this term is small compared to that term. This is a fixed thing. It will turn out to be the mass energy of the particle. And that turns out to be really large because it has the speed of light in here, which is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. And the momentum has difficulties catching up with this term. You have to be really traveling very fast for this term to be comparable to that one. So the non-relativistic limit is the limit where the momentum is small. So where this is a small contribution to the discriminant in here. Therefore, they said, let's do a Taylor expansion. Let's Taylor expand E as a function of P vector squared, for small P vector squared. If we do that, we obtain the leading order term, the constant term, where P is 0. That's just the square root of m squared and c to the fourth. That's just mc squared. We just rederived E equal mc squared here. That's the lowest order term in the Taylor expansion. And then the next order term is where we differentiate E of P squared with respect to E squared. So we get 1 half, 1 over the square root of all of this. And then we get the derivative of the term inside the square root with respect to P vector squared. We just have left over a C squared. That needs to be evaluated at P equal to 0 because we are Taylor expanding around P squared equal to 0. And then times P vector squared. So just to be clear, we are doing a Taylor expansion in P vector squared. The variable about which we do the expansion is P vector squared. That's why this is the linear term in this. This is the constant term in the expansion, the linear term in the expansion. And the next order term is P vector squared squared. All right. This now at P vector squared equal to 0 has that going away. We have the square root of m squared c to the fourth, so we just mc squared. And then c squared divided by c squared goes away. We just have 1 over m, 1 over 2m really. So we have P vector squared from here divided by 2m plus higher order terms. So what we find here is that the Klein-Gordon equation, when we choose the positive square root in the non-relativistic limit, reduces to the Schrödinger equation, or reduces to the dispersion relation of the Schrödinger equation, with the leading order term that wasn't there in the Schrödinger equation. But we have that other term that was in the Schrödinger equation. And that leading order term, mc squared here, that term is a constant term. In terms of operators, if you replace the e again by I h bar d by dt, and the p by minus I h bar d by dx, you represent these operators on Hilbert space this way, then this term is just multiplied with the identity operator on the Hilbert space. So the Hamiltonian acquires an additional term that's proportional to the identity, which, as we discussed earlier, is harmless. Well, in special relativity, it is harmless, right? Because it's just the addition of a constant term multiplied with the identity operator in the Hilbert space, and we can just drop that for all practical purposes because the dynamics that is generated by a Hamiltonian is generated by commutation with the observables. And of course, the identity operator commutes with everything. So this term will never contribute to the dynamics of any quantum system. So we can then rightfully say that in this sense, this approximation, the Schrödinger equation arises from the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, it turns out that the negative solutions, in principle, are also there. Which means that for every positive energy solution, by symmetry of what's going on here, we also have a negative energy solution. And that's a problem, because if a theory has not only arbitrarily large positive energies, but also arbitrarily large negative energies, then it's a bottomless pit. It's more dangerous than a bottomless pit. If you have a quantum system with a Hamiltonian that's unbounded from below, if the energy is not bounded from below, and you see it's definitely not bounded from above, and because you get the negatives as well, it's also not bounded from below, then in principle that system could sink further and further down in energy while conservation of energy, emitting energy, emitting quanta of some kind. So that would be a huge explosion. It never ends, and it would just pump out infinite amount of energy. So it's a general expectation that all physical theories have to have a bound, an energy spectrum that's bounded from below, finitely from below. And that theory didn't have that. Okay, so for small momenta, the Klein-Gordon equation in this limited sense becomes the Schrödinger equation, and we obtain this again. And then, as I already mentioned, this extra term, mc squared, which is just the mass energy of our electron or whatever particle we're dealing with, that extra term in principle is there, but it doesn't affect the dynamics of any observable because it's multiplied with the identity operator. And I even wrote it out. Remember that in quantum theory, the time evolution of any observable f hat, so ih bar d by dt of f hat could be q or p or any other observable, the time evolution in the Heisenberg picture that we work with here is given by the commutator of that observable with the Hamiltonian. But if we take the Hamiltonian and add to it a constant times the identity operator, well, that identity operator commutes with f, and therefore it's the same as just commuting f with Hamiltonian, which is why we can neglect that term. Okay. Right. A few remarks before we move on. The negative energy solutions spoil the interpretation of psi of x and t as a probability amplitude density. So going to the Klein-Gordon equation means we can no longer maintain the interpretation that the modulus squared of psi of x and t is the probability for finding a particle at this particular location. Essentially because the negative energy solutions will be associated with antiparticles. So we have two kinds of particles around, particles and antiparticles. And the same field, psi of x and t, describes the dynamics of both of them. And you can't really disentangle the two of them. And there's no clean probability amplitude for finding a particle at a location interpretation anymore. And that is a deep problem that simply cannot be fixed unless you go as far as going to second quantization. So simply replacing the Schrödinger equation by the Klein-Gordon equation is not enough. We get covariance, but we lose important requirements of quantum mechanics. Now, Klein and Gordon were successful in some regard, in that they found a relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation. But it soon turned out that there are many ways, that there are many different covariant generalizations that you can write down to the Schrödinger equation. There are many different covariant wave equations that could be considered. And so then in the 40s, Eugene Wigner classified all the possibilities. And what he found is that relativistically covariant wave equations can be classified by two numbers, the spin of the particles and the mass of these particles. So in particular, the spin of if the spin of the particles is zero, they don't have their own angular momentum, then that's that gives us the Klein-Gordon equation. And examples of fields that obey the Klein-Gordon equation, but in a second quantized way, not just in the simple way that I explained so far, and examples of actual physical particles that are described by the Klein-Gordon equations are the Higgs particle and the inflaton particle. These are the only two particles that we know of, fundamental particles that we know of, that are scalar, that are scalar and spin zero is synonymous, that are described by the Klein-Gordon equation. Now I added here pi zero, pi plus, pi minus, and I could have added a bunch of other particles as well. There are dozens, actually, that are also described by the Klein-Gordon equation, but these are not fundamental particles. These are composite particles. For example, the pi naught particle is made out of two quarks, a quark and an antiquark. And each one of these quarks is actually a spin 1/2 particle. But they're combined in such a way that they form together a spin zero particle that then obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. So among the fundamental particles that obey the Klein-Gordon equations, we only know of two, the Higgs and the inflaton particle. We don't believe that they are composite particles made out of something. It's been considered, of course, but it's uphill. There are strong indications that they are not consisting of anything else, the Higgs and the inflaton particles. But then you can always create molecules and atoms which are of spin zero, and therefore in principle described by the Klein-Gordon equation, but not fundamentally. If you probe them with sufficiently high energy accelerators, they fall apart. And then you see what their constituents obey, and that's generally the Dirac equation, or Maxwell equations, and things like that. So then there are spin 1/2 particles that they are always described by the Dirac equation. And examples for particles described by the Dirac equation, fundamental particles that are described by the Dirac equation, there's the electrons, the neutrinos, and the quarks. I've also added protons and neutrons. They're also described by the Dirac equation. But again, they are not fundamental particles. They're made out of three quarks each, which individually obey a Dirac equation. And then there are spin 1 particles. And these are, for example, the photons and the gluons. They are described by the Maxwell equations, or more generally, by the Maxwell-Young-Mills equations. This is the case for massless particles, massless photons, massless gluons. In principle, you could consider also massive spin 1 particles, but we don't know of any fundamental ones. But you can make composite particles that would have spin 1 and a mass. Now, how about higher spins? About higher spins, there is the physical evidence, and there are mathematical considerations. The physical evidence is that there are higher spin particles, even spin 10, but none of them are fundamental. They're all composites. You can take a big molecule, and it's probably in a high spin state. For some reason, there are no known fundamental particles that have a spin larger than 1. No known experimentally confirmed particles, fundamental particles, indivisible particles that have a spin larger than 1. So that's the physical evidence. The mathematical perspective on this is that if particles had a spin larger than 1, if you can write down wave equations, and Wigner showed what the options are. When you look at wave equations for particles of spin larger than 1, and you do the second quantization procedure on them, you find that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and that's as many dimensions as we believe we have, then they will not be what is called renormalizable. And renormalizability is a condition on, I wouldn't say consistency of the theory, but on predictive power. If a theory is not renormalizable, it means that if you probe the theory at higher and higher energies, you need to take into account more and more terms in the Lagrangian, for which you need to make measurements to fix the coefficients with which they occur in the Lagrangian. And in principle, as you go to arbitrarily high energies, you need arbitrarily many terms. And that kind of defeats the purpose of writing down a theory. Because if you have to do infinitely many measurements to make infinitely many predictions, then it's not clear how strong the predictive power of your theory is. Now, it's been suggested, most notably by Weinberg, that non-renormalizability of a theory is not necessarily a death sentence for that theory. It could be that the number of terms that extra arise in the Lagrangian as you go to high and high energies grows very slowly, maybe slowly enough so that you can go to the highest energy scales and still have get away with essentially a finite number of extra terms, in which case a non-renormalizable theory would be what is called in the ultraviolet safe. There's evidence that that might occur, and that has to do with one of the forces, one of the kinds of particles that I didn't mention yet, which is gravity and its gravitons. Gravity and its gravitons, according to the Einstein equation, should be spin 2. Gravitons don't fit the Klein-Gordon equation, Dirac equation, or Maxwell equations. If you linearize the Einstein equations, you get equations for a spin 2 particle. And that means that gravity should be non-renormalizable in 3 plus 1 dimensions. But then gravity may be non-renormalizable in a sort of manageable way. But it has been too hard to actually prove that. It could be that just simply everything changes as we go to the ultraviolet. But it could also be that quantum field theory persists right all the way up to the Planck scale, and non-renormalizability is somehow a contained problem. I think it's exciting to know that there is a possibility for this to be workable, but there is no conclusive evidence that gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions has this property of being asymptotically safe. So for now, we've reviewed harmonic oscillators, discussed relativistic fields. Now, let's start with second quantization. As I mentioned on Friday, we are really lucky when we do quantum field theory for cosmology, because the simplest of all fields, the Klein-Gordon fields, of spin 1, seem to be the only ones that matter in cosmology, at least in very early universe cosmology, at least as far as we know so far. The main contribution came from spin 0 particles, so that means we get away with not carrying a lot of indices around, and you know, for the Maxwell equation and the spin and the spin 1/2 Dirac equation, we'd have to carry around a lot of indices, but instead we can just work with the Klein-Gordon field, and we don't also have to worry about gauge degrees of freedom as we would have for fermions and bosons of the spin 1 kind. Also, from now on, we will switch the terminology to the modern terminology. We will no longer speak of wave functions, psi, like the Schrödinger wave function, but instead it's fields. And instead of writing psi, because psi we will later need to describe states in quantum field theory, we will write phi for the fields. And of course the phi will stand for Klein-Gordon fields. In general, we would be looking at A fields for the for electromagnetism, for QCD, for the strong interaction, it would be called the B field, and so on. So we will talk about fields instead of wave functions. We will later get a new notion of wave function for the quantum field theory. Remember what a wave function truly is? The wave function is the collection of coefficients that a state has in a basis. And that concept persists in quantum field theory. It will only be way more abstract than it is for ordinary quantum mechanics. And that's because in quantum field theory, the observables are not going to be position and momentum operators. We're not going to have position momentum representations of the usual kind. So our wave functions are not going to be position wave functions or momentum wave functions. They're going to be taking place in a different space because we'll be diagonalizing other operators, field operators, instead of Q and P operators. Okay, so for now, let's just keep in mind, we change the terminology. We will speak of all functions of space and time as being fields. And then, in analogy to what we do in first quantization, we will introduce for every degree of freedom its canonically conjugate degree of freedom. In ordinary quantum mechanics, we have that every particle has three position degrees of freedom, and we introduced for those the momentum degrees of freedom. Now, for a field, the degree of freedom is its amplitude. Just like for the lake, no, what's the height? What is the amplitude of the wave? And the amplitude is described by phi. So x and t, you can think of x and t for now as a stage. These are just the coordinates on a stage on which things are happening. And what is happening is the amplitude of the field. So what we are interested in dynamically is not how x changes over time, because x doesn't change over time. This is a stage, right? It's just space-time, all x, all t. We don't have a particle moving in space and time anymore. We have a wave that lives in all of space and time. And what is moving, what is dynamical in a classical field theory and now also in a quantum field theory, what is dynamical is the amplitude of the field. Not x, not t. What is dynamical is the amplitude of the field. The field has everywhere an amplitude, and everywhere that amplitude can go up, it can go down. So our degrees of freedom are right off the bat way more than we had in ordinary quantum mechanics. In ordinary quantum mechanics, if you were dealing with one particle, you had 3 degrees of freedom, 3 positions, and their canonically conjugate momenta. If you had 20 particles, you had 60 degrees of freedom, right? Because each one brings in 3 positions with their momenta. But when we are dealing with one single Klein-Gordon field, it has infinitely many degrees of freedom to start with. In fact, uncountably infinitely many degrees of freedom, it seems. Because at every location, x and t, at every position in space and time, it has an amplitude. And that amplitude is dynamical. That amplitude can go up and down, just like the cork and the first slide could go up and down. Here, the field phi can go up and down as a function of time. What we're interested in is the dynamics of the amplitude. How does phi depend on time? What is the uncertainty in the value of phi? What we want to measure might be the amplitude in phi. We may want to measure phi. Phi is becoming an observable. And since we have at every location x a degree of freedom phi, at every location x we also need a canonically conjugate degree of freedom, which we may call pi. So pi is the momentum, the canonically conjugate momentum to phi. So at every location x in space, we have a degree of freedom, the amplitude, and it has a canonically conjugate momentum, pi. And in the case of Minkowski space, pi of x and t is simply phi dot. Very similar to ordinary quantum mechanics, where whenever we have a position operator, the momentum operator is essentially just a derivative, the time derivative of the position operator, up to a factor of a mass, right, for a free particle. But that could be absorbed in the redefinition of the units. Mm-hmm. Okay. So for now, the canonically conjugate momentum field to phi is just the time derivative. Later, we will do this properly, and we will derive the canonically conjugate variable the way it's supposed to be done, and the way you've probably done it in previous courses when you studied how to do the Legendre transform to go from a Hamiltonian description to a Lagrangian description of a system. When you have the Lagrangian description of a system, you have Q and P. You have Q and Q dot. You have a degree of freedom and its time derivative. If you go to the Hamiltonian description, you have Q and P. And how is P expressed in terms of Q dot? Well, you take the Lagrangian, differentiate it with respect to Q dot, and what you get is the canonically conjugate momentum for the Legendre transform. So we will do that similarly. And when we do that, when we write down the Lagrangian formalism for a field such as the Klein-Gordon field, then we will have the field phi and its time derivatives and its space derivatives. And in order to get the canonically conjugate field, we will differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of the field. And what we then get is not necessarily phi dot, because on curved space-time, the Lagrangian is no longer simply the square of the time derivative plus the square of the space derivative. It's more complicated. There's the metric in there. And so what we can already anticipate here is that when we do quantum field theory on curved space-time, the relationship between the canonically conjugate momentum to the degree of freedom and the degree of freedom itself will be non-trivial. In fact, there will be plenty of terms on the right-hand side in general. But for now that we still do this on Minkowski space, we can say that this equation is very similar. It's completely analogous, actually, to the equation that the momentum operator is simply Q dot in ordinary first quantized quantum mechanics, where ordinarily we have maybe several position operators, several momentum operators, but here we have, for every x, we have a degree of freedom phi and its canonically conjugated momentum pi of x. So keep in mind that every location x, we have an independent quantum system, an independent degree of freedom, which will be a harmonic oscillator, but not a free harmonic oscillator, a harmonic oscillator that's coupled to its neighbors.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it obvious that if I want to do canonical quantization, I must first be able to do a Legendre transform?
No, you could also start. You could start from a Hamiltonian formalism, but then you have to be really good at guessing what the canonically conjugate momentum would be.
But does that mean that if a field has a quantum, like I have a quantum field theory or something, it must mean that if I try to do a Hamiltonian equation of motion, it must go through? Because not every random Hamiltonian has a Legendre transform, I guess.
Yes, there is an obstacle to doing this Legendre transform, and usually that obstacle is a gauge symmetry. So, for example, if you do electromagnetism or Young-Mills theory, then there is a problem going from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian picture, and that means that you have to do gauge fixing and so on. Now, luckily for Klein-Gordon field, that's not going to happen, because it doesn't happen. And actually, that's why later in the course, we will pursue this way. We will want to do the quantization in the Hamiltonian picture. Have a Hamiltonian, have observables, have commutators. This is generating time evolution. However, in general relativity, it is highly non-trivial to maintain covariance. Therefore, we will first formulate the Klein-Gordon theory in a covariant way, which means with the action and the Lagrangian. And this way, we will ensure that everything is nicely covariant. And once we have the covariant theory, then we allow ourselves to do a Legendre transform. And it's just a transform. It doesn't change anything. It's just another way of looking at things. We do a Legendre transform to the Hamiltonian formalism, which doesn't look covariant at all. But it is, because we've just reformulated things using the Legendre transform. If, on the other hand, we wanted to do it right away in the Hamiltonian formalism, then we would have to be really good at guessing what the canonically conjugate momentum field is so that the whole thing remains coherent. So we'll do it through the detour of the Lagrangian formalism, just for covariance. Okay, so now that we have introduced the canonically conjugate momentum field, we can rewrite the Klein-Gordon equation. Here's the Klein-Gordon equation again. All I've done is that I've replaced the second time derivative of phi by the first time derivative of pi. Okay, so that's how the Klein-Gordon equation now looks like. The Klein-Gordon equation, here it is again, by the way, does not couple the real part of phi to the imaginary part of phi. If there was, for example, an I in here, well then that means that the real part and the imaginary part of phi would be coupled to each other. But because everything is real in here, the real part and the imaginary part of phi independently obey the Klein-Gordon equation. And what that means is that we can restrict attention to just the real part. The imaginary part will be just the same. If we want to upgrade our field from a real valued field to a complex valued field, we can always do that in a straightforward way. It's just the old thing twice, the real part plus the imaginary part, because they don't couple. You see, in the Schrödinger equation, you have I's all over the place, right? I mean, there's an I on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side is real. And that means that in the Schrödinger equation, the real and the imaginary part couple. And so in general, you can't just say, I've solved it for the real part. And you know, it's not the case that, the real part and the imaginary part independently obey the Schrödinger equation. But the real part and the imaginary part independently do obey the Klein-Gordon equation. So therefore, we will now restrict attention to just a real-valued field phi. And it turns out that this simplification is, in fact, sufficient for cosmology. It is as simple as one can hope for. Okay, and then we arrive at the quantization conditions.
Question?
Yes?
Does the conservation equation or Klein-Gordon equation relate the real and the imaginary part? That's a charge conservation. Because you have to multiply that phi star there, right?
I think the answer is that no, it doesn't relate them dynamically. You still have that. The only equations of motion that the solutions have to obey are the individually the Klein-Gordon equation for the one and for the other. But you're right, the equation itself mixes the two. And we will later see the significance of that in quantum field theory. You're right that if we were looking at just the first quantized Klein-Gordon theory, then this would be about the conservation of charge. That's just to give an intuition for it. But later on, we will see that that conservation equation that we have there, which in the Schrödinger case would be the conservation of probability amplitudes, in the case of second quantization quantum field theory, that conservation equation is what is mathematically known as a Wronskian, in case you've done some partial differential equations. And that conservation is technically the conservation of the commutation relations. And what that will do is, I don't know, there's no way to explain that without confusing you, I think. Later on, when we will do the second quantization of a Klein-Gordon field, we will do that using a particular mathematical tool. We will use so-called mode functions and then the creation and annihilation operators and so on. And we will find that because of that condition, this Wronskian condition, because of this requirement that the commutation relations are preserved, the so-called mode functions will have to be solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation that cannot be completely real or completely imaginary. They have to be linear combinations of the two. And that will have certain consequences. Maybe for now, suffice it to say that this will come back. So Yes. So, so as far as the dynamics is concerned, the real part and the imaginary part are independent of each other. And if we make a field complex, if we make a scalar field complex, the benefit, as far as the physics is concerned, is that we can describe charged particles. And a real value Klein-Gordon field only describes neutral particles. So a complex Klein-Gordon field could be coupled to electromagnetism. A real valued Klein-Gordon field could not be coupled to electromagnetism, at least not in a standard way. It would generally not see photons, or photons wouldn't see it. And there will be some issues with complex and real valued fields later on when we develop solution methods for quantum field theories. Okay, now let's look at the quantization conditions. In first quantization, the quantization conditions were that the degrees of freedom, QA and PA, and A is just a label to count the degrees of freedom. So this could be A running from 1 to 3 in the case of one particle in three dimensions. But if you have 100 particles, then A would run from 1 to 300 because each particle contributes three of those. So we have that the canonical computation between the Qs and the Ps is given given by that. The Qs, degrees of freedom, commute among each other at equal time, and the canonically conjugate momenta also commute among each other at equal time. By the way, keep in mind that at non-equal time, they may not commute. Okay? But at equal time, they will commute. Equal time, they do commute. And now in quantum field theory, we have at every location x a degree of freedom phi. And I've put a hat on it to indicate it's an operator now. So at every position x, we have a degree of freedom phi that evolves in time, that has uncertainties, that has expectation values, and so on. And we have a canonically conjugate degree of freedom pi, also at all positions. And if we look at a degree of freedom and its canonically conjugate, at equal time, that's important, but different degrees of freedom, then they commute. If you look at them at the exact same location, so that this is actually the canonically conjugate to that particular phi, if this x prime is the same as this x, well, then this Dirac delta peaks and you have non-commutativity. But there's a big difference to that case, because here, this is a Kronecker delta. It only goes as high as 1. This one, you know, is distributional. So you may think of it as going to infinity, but it's divergent. So we should expect to get some non-trivialities arising from the fact that here on the right-hand side, we have Dirac deltas rather than Kronecker deltas. Now, these equations of these canonical commutation relations are harmless in comparison and very similar to those. Now, the degrees of freedom commute with each other as long as you look at them at equal time. And similarly here, at the position x, we have a degree of freedom phi. At position x prime, we have another degree of freedom, and they always commute, even if you take the exact same degree of freedom. Of course, it commutes with itself. And also, the canonically conjugate momentum, all these are commuting among each other. Yeah?
One question.
OK.
What if I choose different time slicing? Like if I use someone else, another observer, choose another different time coordinates, then how
yes.
will this get affected?
Yes. As long as you do it legally, which is to say, as long as it's an observer, as long as it's a coordinate system that could be the coordinate system of an observer, of an inertial observer, you're fine, it's still true. And the reason is that these are vanishing as long as these are space-like to each other. So if you do a Lorentz transformation, space-like goes into space-like. And so that's still true. But if you allow yourself a Lorentz a transformation that wouldn't be obtainable by just boosting. So if you take coordinates that such that you go from space-like separation, you see these are space-like separated because they're at equal time and different position, to time-like separation. For time-like separation, there's no guarantee that they would come. But By the way, let me explain, let me demystify why they may not commute for different times, because that already occurs in first quantization. Let's look at, in first quantization, let's say we want to solve the equation of motion for, look at this, it goes on its own, the equation of motion for a free particle, right? Then what we would have is that x of t is equal to x of t naught plus, equal to plus, and then we have t minus t naught, and then p over m. Agreed? This is in classical mechanics, just how this would work, but in the Heisenberg picture in quantum mechanics, that's still true, right? Agreed? I'm just saying that the position at the later time is the position at the original time plus t times the velocity. And you get that if you write down the equations of motion, the Heisenberg equations of motion for a free particle, that's what you get. And then you solve them, and it's the same equations of motion as in classical mechanics, and with the hat and without the hat, you can solve them the same way by Ehrenfest, same thing. Okay. But now look at the commutator between x hat of t naught and x hat of t. Right? You see, this is of t naught. Because for a free particle, the momentum doesn't change, right? That's why I omitted this. But you can write p of t naught or p of t, doesn't matter. But my point is that this is generally not equal to zero, because the position operator acquires components of the momentum operator over time. So generally, you acquire this non-commutativity. And that exact same phenomenon happens for quantum fields as well. They acquire over time components of pi, and that's how that happens. But only within their light cone. So it has to be costed. You can't have superluminal propagation. And so as long as you are space-like separated, they will be commuting. We will do all of these things much more carefully later on and prove these things, the independence, I mean, the covariance of the whole thing. Yeah, we'd have to do this very carefully, right? Because we, on one hand, we want to use the Hamiltonian picture, but the Hamiltonian picture is not obviously covariant. So we'll have to do that very carefully. OK, so we have here the canonical commutation relations for the fields. And as always, we keep the equations of motion from before, from the classical theory. So classically, we had that pi, the canonically conjugate momentum field, was simply the time derivative of phi for Minkowski space. Later on, we'll have to make this covariant. I mean, it is covariant, but only for Minkowski space. And we had the Klein-Gordon equation, now expressed in terms of pi and phi. So we will keep these two equations of motion. We will keep these two equations of motion and now have to solve them with these canonical commutation relations. Also, we were looking at real-valued Klein-Gordon fields because we got away with this restriction. It's very convenient. So for the classical fields, it meant that phi star is equal to phi. And now we implement the rule that this means that as operators, they will have to obey phi dagger equal to phi. Now, this will, what you see on this slide will set a general theme for throughout the course, because it summarizes the structure of the problem that we have to solve. We have to solve equations of motion, which are generally the same as for the classical theory, subject to the additional conditions that the canonical commutation relations have to be obeyed, and that these so-called hermeticity conditions are also fulfilled. I said hermeticity conditions, plural, because I forgot to write down the other one. For pi as well, we have that pi dagger is pi. So ultimately in this course, as far as solution methods are concerned, we'll try to find methods to solve these three things. Equations of motion, canonical commutation relations, and hermeticity conditions. And a lot will ride on making the right answer, right solution answers, where we try to solve. Usually we can do a solution answers where we make sure that we, first of all, solve that, get this out of the way, and then focus on the dynamics. You will see how that works. So instead of trying to solve everything at once, we'll try to partition the problem and solve these three things in clever, separated ways. Now, in second quantization, it might seem that because we went to the Klein-Gordon equation, we no longer have a Hamiltonian. We seem to have equations of motion, canonical commutation relations, and hermeticity conditions, and so on. Everything looks very much like ordinary quantum mechanics, but do we still have a Hamiltonian? And we do. But now it's got to be a Hamiltonian from which we can derive the equations of motion, and they are, in this case, the two equations of motion that we had earlier, these ones. This one, right? So now the equations of motion are nothing like e squared minus p squared equal m squared or something like that. No. The equations of motion are no longer like the first quantized things. These are the equations of motion. We need equations of motion, differential equations, to be obeyed by operator-valued fields. And operator-valued, that's what it's indicated by the hat. So, can we find a Hamiltonian for second quantization? And yes, here it is. So this is the Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space. It is actually quite similar to the Hamiltonian of a bunch of harmonic oscillators. Here is the Hamiltonian of first quantization of a bunch of harmonic oscillators. It starts out with terms PA squared over 2, I dropped the m, you just use units such that the mass is 1. So you have the kinetic terms of the harmonic oscillators, and then you have frequency terms times the position squared. So this is just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. The momenta and the positions have indices a, and so the a is just labeling all the positions and all the momenta of these harmonic oscillators. So this is the Hamiltonian of a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And they also can have different frequencies. So for each degree of freedom A, we may have a different frequency omega. Let's just allow ourselves to have that. The structure of the Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field is similar. And that's where we get back to this picture of the lake at the very beginning of the first slide there, where we said that if you put a cork there, it will bob up and down, oscillate. The quantum field consists of harmonic oscillators. At every point in space, there's a harmonic oscillator. For the lake, that's certainly true. At every point on the lake, you have a harmonic oscillator, and these guys are coupled to each other. If you shake the lake at one point, if you make the water move at one point, the water elsewhere will soon learn about it. Waves will travel because these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. That is what's going on here as well. Let's see how that comes about. Well, at every position x, I mean, we're integrating here over all d3x, right? And at every position x, we have the momentum squared. That's like for every a, we have a momentum squared. So, and with a proper 1/2 as well in front of it. So at every x, we have the momentum squared. And then we have, in the first quantized case, frequency squared times position squared. Let's see. Here we have a constant, just like our omega a squared. We have a constant, in this case it's the mass of the Klein-Gordon field, with a constant times phi squared. So that's very similar. You see, we have the p squared over 2m, the first term over there, and then we have a constant times the actual degree of freedom itself squared. So the degree of freedom itself is phi, phi squared m squared, and here we have pi squared. So if the Laplacian was absent, we would have strictly, exactly, at every point in space, a harmonic oscillator. Right? We have here the momentum squared. Here we have the phi squared multiplied with that. We can even tell right away what the frequency is. We can read off what the frequency is. It's omega. Right? Omega is m, right? Just from reading it off this way. So we have, at every point in space, a harmonic oscillator. In fact, you know, it's uncountably many harmonic oscillators because we have uncountably many positions in space. But we also have the Laplacian term. We don't have that here. What could that Laplacian term do?
Gives you energy for particles with momentum.
True, but I'm looking for something else.
It couples them at different positions.
Exactly, right. This is the reason why these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. Or in the picture of the lake, it's why if you do something with the water here, the water over there will soon learn about it, because these things are coupled to each other.
If you were to write this for the Fourier components of phi, would they be uncoupled or would the m?
Yes, very good, very good. Let me get to that in a moment.
Okay.
So for now, I'm writing this here in the position representation, and then we have here space derivatives. If you discretize space for a moment, you know what the derivatives do? They take the value of the field at one location minus the value of the field at another location. In other words, this Hamiltonian couples the field at one location to the field at another location. That is why this term is a coupling term between these harmonic oscillators. Okay? So what we see from this perspective in the position representation is that the Hamiltonian of a quantum field describes a system which has at every location in X a harmonic oscillator sitting, and these harmonic oscillators are coupled because of the Laplacian. Now, if on curved space, this formula changes a bit, as it does, then there will be a metric coefficients in here and there and everywhere. The metric, the curvature of space-time, will affect this formula for the Hamiltonian. And that means that these harmonic oscillators, one at each position, these harmonic oscillators will be individually a little bit modified by the curvature, but also the way that they couple to each other will be modified. Okay, now back to your point. If we now Fourier transform the whole thing into momentum space, then we have a D3P integration here. And this Laplacian simply becomes p vector squared. Now it's no longer a derivative. Now it's no longer coupling the harmonic oscillators to each other. What do we have now? Now we have here still momenta squared, still phi squared. Therefore, we still have harmonic oscillators, but now different ones, the Fourier transformed ones. Now we see that in momentum space, we have that at every point in momentum space, we have a harmonic oscillator, and these guys are not coupled to each other because there's no derivative that could couple them. The p squared term here will simply combine with the m squared term to give us the frequency. And that's the reason why it is usually super convenient to perform a Fourier transform, because then we get a bunch of harmonic oscillators that are uncoupled. And uncoupled harmonic oscillators, we know how to quantize. We know how to solve them. And then we can always Fourier transform back into position representation and find out everything about the coupled harmonic oscillators, because we've already solved the problem. And of course, that exercise we will do. And then we'll have to do that with curvature, with the presence of expansion of space-time, curvature of space-time, horizons, black holes, that sort of thing. All right, so the claim was that this is the Hamiltonian for second quantization. Now, I just put that there. It needs to be proven that this is right. How do we see that this is the correct Hamiltonian? Well, it has to give us the correct equations of motion. Remember that in quantum theory, the equations of motion are always of this form. IH bar, the time derivative of an observable, no matter what it is, IH bar, the time derivative of the observable, is given by the commutator of that observable with the Hamiltonian. So in particular, we may be interested in the time derivative of the observable phi. I'm easily saying here that phi is an observable. That doesn't mean that it's easy to actually perform a measurement that would lead to that. Just a moment. It would give us the value of phi. I'm simply calling every self-adjoint operator now an observable. Okay. So, for example, we might be interested in the dynamics of phi itself, which is an observable. It's a self-adjoint operator. For every x, it's a self-adjoint operator. We want to know what is the time evolution of the amplitude of phi at x. And it's supposed to be, if this is still a quantum theory, what we do, the commutator of phi with the Hamiltonian. So you take the phi, plug this Hamiltonian in there, and work it out. And it better be what it's supposed to be, which is essentially the momentum field, right? Phi dot is supposed to be the momentum field. And similarly, the dynamics of the canonically conjugate momentum field should be given by the commutator of pi with h, and that better be the Klein-Gordon equation now. Yes?
Is there an extra term for an explicitly time-dependent operator?
Yes, in principle, if your f is explicitly time-dependent, if you choose to look at an observable where you by hand put an extra time dependence.
But you gave it one. But you gave it an explicit time dependence.
Oh, no. That's not an extra time dependence. An extra time dependence would be if you consider, for example, phi of x and t plus cosine of t times pi of x and t. Right? Now, that cosine, that was your choice. And that's something that would be picked up by an extra term. Okay, and so this can be checked. So it can be checked whether when you plug that Hamiltonian into these commutators, you obtain here phi dot is equal to pi, and here pi dot equal to the right-hand side of the Klein-Gordon equation. And I will just show you one example of it. And then we are done for today. So for example, the IH bar phi dot equal to the commutator of phi with h equation. Let's check whether this is really IH bar times pi, as it should be. So we take the commutator of phi with h, commutator of phi with, here's h. This is the Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field. And I wrote it as 1/2 pi hat squared plus something in phi, because it doesn't really matter what it is in phi, because phi commutes with phi. It's at equal time after all, right? So this is h of t and phi of t. I should have written a t here. So these guys commute anyway, so they will go away. We just have to calculate the commutator between phi and pi squared. And how does that work out? I mean, of course, you've many times evaluated commutators. But in second quantization, it's in principle the same, but you will encounter Dirac deltas and integrals. So here's how that works out. I'm carrying forward the phi here, and then 1/2 pi hat squared. Well, so we have a commutator of the form a with b squared, commutator of ab squared. Okay, so, commutator of a with b squared, so that's b commutator of a. B plus commutator of A, B, B, right? So that's what we get here. We have the commutator of phi with pi and the pi outside plus the pi on the left, commutator of phi with pi. The commutator between phi and pi is a Dirac delta. Remember that they are taken at equal time, but not equal arbitrary x and x prime. So this is going to give us a Dirac delta times pi. And here we have pi times, well, another Dirac delta. So we have IH bar 1/2, and then Dirac delta times pi plus pi squared, pi hat times Dirac delta. We integrate over d3x, get rid of the Dirac deltas in this way, and we obtain that this is just pi. There's, I mean, we get twice the pi, but there's a 1/2 factor there. And that means we get that pi times IH bar, which is what we should get, because it means that if we divide by IH bar on the left and on the right, we obtain that pi, the pi field is the phi dot. And similarly, you can do, and I invite you to do that, it's really useful, to check that this equation is really the Klein-Gordon equation. In this case, it's a little bit more involved because you have to work with these terms with the Laplacian and so on. There's something to think about. Try it out and you get the right thing. And that's it for today. Yes?
Is the Hamiltonian time independent?
The Hamiltonian is time independent, yes.
But also, it doesn't make sense to talk about commutator of two Hamiltonians at different times, does it?
That's right. It's constant in time. Yeah. You see, we haven't introduced any time dependence in the Hamiltonian if you look at it.
Which means that there is a time translation symmetry in this.
There is, yes. But in general, yeah, we could have a time dependence. And then we have to worry about the time evolution. We have to use the time ordering operator. And all of that goes into perturbation theory then.
And another thing is Heisenberg equation of motion carries over to QFT, does it?
Yes, that's right. So as always, the equations of motion stay the same. And the commutation relations change. Hermeticity condition, and that's all you have to worry about. The fact that the equations of motion stay the same is actually the result of an analysis that Dirac first did. And if you're not familiar with that, I invite you to look at my lecture notes for my quantum course where I study that in great detail. The gist of it is this, that classical mechanics is described by a Poisson algebra, which is to say it's an associative algebra and a Lie algebra that are mutually compatible with distributive laws. And quantum mechanics is described by Poisson algebra. And they are almost the same. They have the same Lie algebra structure. And only the associative algebra becomes slightly non-commutative. But because the Lie algebra structure stays identically the same, and the Lie algebra structure is what determines the evolution, so the Poisson brackets, the Poisson algebra consists of a Lie algebra and an associative algebra, and the Poisson bracket is the Lie bracket. Because the Lie bracket determines the time evolution, and it doesn't change, the equations of motion stay the same.
Mm-hmm. When we do this for an expanding universe, will that appear as an explicit time dependence in the Hamiltonian? Or?
Yes, it will.
Okay.
That's right. And in the expanding universe, time is not conserved for that very reason. So not time, energy is not conserved. That's right. Yes, in nature, energy is not conserved. Yes?
Could I have projected the stress tensor onto a foliation and gotten H that way, and then put out something?
Sorry, I didn't get the beginning
could
of
it. I have like, written down the classical stress tensor and then like projected it onto a foliation. And
sorry, this classical stress energy tensor?
That's right.
Okay, and then?
I projected it onto slices and then got an H that way. Like the time-time component of T.
Oh, okay. So this leads to something very interesting that we will cover in one of the last lectures, I don't remember, the 19th or something. Namely, the Hamiltonian can be obtained in two different ways. You can either say the Hamiltonian is what generates the time evolution, or you can say the Hamiltonian is what you get when you take the stress energy tensor, its zero, zero component, and integrate it over space. And the two notions are almost the same, but they're not the same. And there is something non-trivial going on between them, but I'm afraid it would be more confusing than enlightening if I explained it now. But you can already look it up in the lecture notes of 2 years ago. That's a good point. It's interesting that the Hamiltonian has two origins. and in that sense the energy. And what I think is more fundamentally the energy is the energy from the energy momentum tensor, because that's the thing that gravitates. The thing that generates evolution is very much dependent on diffeomorphisms, on how you choose your coordinate system, what you consider your time to be. Okay, see you on Friday.